Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel on Thursday, October 15th, 2020. Polls open for the 2020 general election and turnout is already high. By Abby Perot. As early voting for the 2020 election opened on Tuesday, first day turnout records across Texas were smashed. Locally, a modest line formed outside the USO building in Marfa ahead of the 8 a.m. poll opening. And by the end of the day, 222 Presidio County residents had voted in person, more than deputy clerk and former elections clerk Florcita Zubia had ever seen on a single day. Of those 222, 79 voted in Marfa, and 143 cast their ballot in Presidio at the Annex Building C. Presidio County Tax Assessor-Collector Natalia Williams, the county's voter registration official, said 4,793 voters are registered for the 2020 election, slightly lower than 2016. Less than half of the voting age population turned out to cast a ballot in the last presidential election year in Texas, and West Texas's chronically low turnout is no exception. While 6,178 adults lived in the county in 2016, only 4,806 were registered in Presidio County then, and only 2,208 of those residents voted in those November elections, according to the Secretary of State. At the USO building on Tuesday, the line was spaced out as voters tried to social distance that morning. Inside, election officials were spraying down high contact surfaces with Lysol and reminding voters that if they had ordered mail-in ballots, they would not be able to vote in person unless they brought in the mail ballot, completed an application to render it, and turned the unused mail ballot over to poll workers. Some voters attempted to turn in filled-out mail-in ballots in person at the polling site rather than through the U.S. Postal Service. One voter stuck their mail-in ballot in the in-person ballot counting machine before they could be stopped, which prompted confusion but was later resolved. Election officials reminded the public that hand-delivered mail-in ballots should be dropped off at the clerk's office at the Presidio County Courthouse, not at the USO or the Annex. Even though the courthouse has temporarily closed its offices due to a rise in COVID-19 cases locally, the east entrance facing the jail will still be open for those needing to drop off mail-in ballots at the county clerk's office. While distancing is being observed at the polls with the help of floor markers keeping the line spread out, there are still challenges to protecting against COVID-19 this year. At the USO, there is only one door where voters enter and exit, causing those leaving to briefly come close to those waiting in line. Zubia said the election officials are limited in what they can do. They want to avoid having voters use other side doors, since they don't have the capacity to monitor any more entrances or exits. On top of monitoring entries, the USO building side entrance that has been used in the past no longer has a ramp, just steep steps, she said. It's a little hard at this point. We're hoping everybody can be patient, she said, and continue to use the main door. The officials are monitoring the polling sites to see if any improvements or changes need to be made. Speaking of coronavirus, Zubia said those who have tested positive and are quarantining can still vote in person, but at a distance by voting curbside. Election workers will take the ballot out to the car of any person who is COVID-19 positive. To request curbside voting, call 432-729-4812 or have a COVID-19 negative person alert poll workers in the facility that you are waiting outside. Across the room from the county-run elections at the USO, the Marfa City elections are also taking place on a separate ballot. Usually held in March, the city elections were postponed to November at the permission of Texas Governor Greg Abbott due to the pandemic conditions. Voters who live in Marfa city limits will elect three council members and vote on a proposition determining whether the city will regain control of negotiating contracts with AEP. In the city of Presidio, two city council candidates filed to run for two open seats, so a city election will not take place due to the lack of a competitive race. Early voting runs through October 30th, and Election Day is Tuesday, November 3rd, and is held at the USO building in Marfa and the Annex Building C in Presidio. During early voting, registered voters can cast a ballot at either location. On Election Day, voters in Precincts 1 and 7 must vote in Marfa, and voters in Precincts 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 must vote in Presidio. Early voting takes place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day, except on October 21st and October 28th, when the polls have extended hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Election day hours are November 3rd, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Presidio election officials are accepting calls for any questions, comments, or concerns from the public at 432-729-4812. "This election is so sensitive," said Zubia. "We want everybody to feel comfortable when they're coming to vote. If they feel like anything isn't right, they can call our office and verify." Coronavirus: Live Updates for the Big Bend Region by Abby Perrot and Stephen Paulson. Last updated October 15th, 4:22 p.m. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara on Thursday afternoon announced 12 more confirmed coronavirus cases in Presidio County, bringing the county's local count to 130. The Texas Department of State Health Services, as of Thursday, is only reporting 122 cases. Of the new cases, 6 are from Marfa and 6 are from Presidio. Of the Marfa cases, 4 are teenagers. Some of the patients will be released from quarantine as early as tomorrow, Friday, or Saturday, suggesting that some of this data is already out of date. Separately, Judge Guevara announced more testing opportunities in Presidio County. There will be a testing site at the City of Presidio EMS and Fire Station in Presidio on Tuesday, October 27th, and at the Presidio County Courthouse in Marfa on Wednesday, October 28th. These testing sites will run from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. and will be oral swab tests. As always, identification is required, but appointments aren't. Departure of top health official leaves Tri-County struggling with data by Stephen Paulson, published October 14th. It's now been more than 2 weeks since Brewster County had a local health authority, after Dr. Ekta Escobar, a pediatrician at the Big Bend Regional Medical Center, resigned in September. And finding a replacement has been a struggle. Elizar Cano, the county judge for Brewster County, said at a county commissioner's court meeting this week. Before Dr. Escobar resigned, she was a regular target of anger and criticism from those in the Tri-County who opposed mask orders and other precautions, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported. And those issues have made other doctors wary about signing up for the role, Cano said. After speaking to 5 doctors, Cano said that so far, at least, there are no takers. He noted that doctors are already busy, that the position is unpaid, and that many did not want to deal with the drama of becoming a public health official in a region where coronavirus precautions are a source of arguments and controversy. They felt like the community was not supportive to Escobar, and that it was real tough to be in that position, Cano explained. There was criticism with not a lot of support. In the meantime, the Tri-County has had to make do with less good data. When Brewster County still had a health authority, the county gave daily updates on everything from hospitalizations and deaths to pending test numbers. Dr. Escobar also gave regular presentations to city and county officials, relaying in simple terms how the region was doing. And because Brewster County has the largest population in the Tri-County, as well as the only university and hospital, government officials and journalists throughout the region also benefited from those updates. Now the region is getting less accurate numbers. At the commissioner's court meeting, Stephanie Elmore, the emergency management coordinator for Brewster County, said she could only get certain updates from the state, including deaths, active case counts, and total case counts. Much of the other state data contains private medical information and therefore is not available to non-doctors, she said. Mike Payanez, a commissioner, asked why he was seeing higher local numbers on CBS7. At press time, the county was reporting 226 confirmed cases in Brewster County, and the state was reporting 233. But the numbers he saw on television for the county were higher, he said. When we did have an LHA, local health authority, the numbers were more accurate and up to date, Elmore agreed. But with Dr. Escobar out as local health authority, we don't have that access. Judge Cano agreed, noting that Dr. Escobar went above and beyond in her duties. The types of data issues Brewster County was now experiencing were more typical for small counties, he said. Big counties like Houston's Harris County have health workers who sort through this information, he said. But Brewster County just had Dr. Escobar. We were almost kind of spoiled, Cano said. Now we're feeling the pinch. In the meantime, Dr. Rachel Sona, the administrator of DSHS Region 910, is acting as Brewster County's fill-in local health authority. But when the Big Bend Sentinel called her for comment this week, an employee at Region 910 said that because Sona is an employee of DSHS, all questions had to be directed through the state media office in Austin. These troubles are happening at the same time that Texas officials are fumbling state data and the Tri-County is seeing a rise in cases. Last week, at least 10 cases were identified at Marfa Public Schools. But by Monday, those cases still weren't included in the state data. By Tuesday, the state numbers were at least mostly up to date. But in the meantime, the lack of information is adding to concerns in the region. Almost 1,000 people were tested in the Tri-County last week. At press time, though, it's still unclear how many of those tests are pending. It's not even clear how many people have so far received positive results. Elmore, the emergency management coordinator, helps put together Brewster County's daily coronavirus updates on social media. But with Elmore not serving as a health official, and therefore depending on Dr. Escobar to get confidential local data, she is no longer getting as much information, she said. Coupled with rising local case numbers, the issue is already affecting official decision-making in the region. Eric Zimmer, the city manager of Alpine, said the city was having to make do with less data. Since ECTA stepped down, the county hasn't provided anything, Zimmer said. Right now, I'm concerned. Law Enforcement Faces Challenges Enforcing Mask Ordinances by Stephen Paulson. There have been a growing number of reports of mask violations throughout the Tri-County, including calls from concerned residents to police. That rise in violations comes despite the fact that Texas still has a mandatory mask rule, as do local governments in the region. Presidio, Brewster, and Jeff Davis counties all have either adopted their own mask rules or have chosen not to seek an exemption from state ones. In Marfa, a local mask ordinance has been in effect for months, and one of Governor Greg Abbott's orders, still in effect, makes not wearing a mask in business and crowded public spaces punishable by up to a $250 fine. But after months of confusing mask guidance from the state, some residents and businesses in the region are either confused about the rules or are defying them. Marfa Police Chief Steve Marquez said he's received multiple complaints about people not wearing masks at the Stripes convenience store on the east side of town. A manager told police the store was not going to require masks. I called him up and advised him that wasn't going to work, Marquez said. Then over the weekend, Marfa police received a complaint regarding the other Stripes on the west side of town. In that case, a caller complained that both customers and employees were ignoring mask rules, Marquez said. Marquez spoke to an area store manager in Fort Stockton. According to Marquez, she told him that the company was worried about losing business from people who did not want to wear masks. Marquez again stressed that Marfa's mask rules were mandatory. At press time, Marfa City leaders were considering next steps, including a possible fine for the company. A spokesperson for Stripes said the company's number one focus was to provide a safe, clean, and excellent customer service experience when visiting our stores. The spokesperson did not comment further on the situation in Marfa, including the allegation that Stripes was intentionally breaking laws to avoid losing business. Any further questions, he said, should be directed to the City of Marfa Police Department. In Marfa last month, a video went viral showing university police trying to escort a maskless man out of the Solross State University rodeo. "I have every right in the world to knock you out," the man tells officers in the video. The rodeo ultimately shut down to everyone but families and coaches, and the incident helped demonstrate the deep anger that some Tri-County residents feel toward mask requirements. Last week, in a letter to the editor, a reader said she had stopped shopping at a Porter's grocery store in Alpine because they weren't doing enough to enforce mask rules. Kai Ellison, a spokesperson for Porter's, directed the Big Bend Sentinel to the company's coronavirus policies and procedures. That document says Porter's has closely followed legal requirements, but does not explicitly list mask requirements for customers, though it does for employees. Ellison did not respond to follow-up questions on the issue. Eric Zimmer, the Alpine city manager, said that since the start of the crisis, some businesses in Alpine have always said, "Hey, we're not going to enforce the mask thing." But with businesses across the country already struggling, the city didn't want to take a heavy-handed approach. "Many of these businesses are on the brink of turning upside down and shutting their doors," Zimmer said. "And that doesn't just affect the business owners," he said. "Each business, at bare minimum, offers 3 to 4 jobs that are needed in the community." Meanwhile, on a recent visit to Fort Davis, maskless customers and employees could be seen at businesses in town. Teresa Todd, the county attorney for Jeff Davis County, said some residents are simply ignoring mask rules. Though authorities can technically ticket people for these offenses, Todd said that would require huge amounts of additional work for her and other county officials, especially if authorities try to enforce the rules consistently. "As busy as I am right now, I can't also take on a caseload of non-mask wearers," she said. In both Alpine and Fort Davis, authorities are taking a light-handed approach toward mask violations, choosing conversations with violators over fines and citations. Back in April, the Brewster County Sheriff's Office said on social media that deputies will not enforce any ordinance related to wearing masks. The sheriff's office cannot be immediately reached for comment on whether that was still its position, but an employee at the sheriff's office said they were getting few complaints anyways. Likewise, for the Alpine Police Department, where Chief Robert Martin said he's received just one complaint from a business, in that case a Porter's, about a customer not wearing a mask. But that issue was resolved by the time police responded, Martin said. And so far, city police have issued 0 citations for people who violate mask rules. "We've tried to take the avenue of asking people to wear masks rather than penalizing people if they don't," Chief Martin said. "I think we've had a lot better success doing it that way." Bill Kitts, the sheriff in Jeff Davis County, agreed. He's also received just one complaint from a business about someone not following mask rules and has also issued no citations. Like Chief Martin, he thought warnings and conversations were more effective. When pressed on this, "What about other laws people didn't want to follow, like rules against drinking in public parks?" Both Martin and Kitts said situations like these were also handled on a case-by-case basis. "There's always discretion," Kitts said. Like Todd, Sheriff Kitts said he was busy enough without also enforcing mask rules across the county. And besides, he was trying to keep his own deputies safe. "We're trying to be extra cautious," he said. "If one of us goes down, we've all got to quarantine. With just a sheriff and 4 deputies for the whole county, Kitts and others weren't looking for verbal confrontations." Brewster County moves to reopen bars. By Stephen Paulson. Bars in Texas are seating customers again. In executive orders last week, Governor Greg Abbott said he would soon allow bars to reopen at 50% capacity. Other service businesses like movie theaters and bowling alleys will also see expanded capacity limits of 75%. The order went into effect this Wednesday, October 14th. While Governor Abbott's statewide mask rules allowed county governments to opt out if they met certain requirements, these orders require county officials to opt in to reopen bars. The governor initially closed bars along with other businesses on March 19th as information about spreading virus was just coming to light. In late May, he authorized their reopening, but as Texas cases soon ticked up, he expressed regret on opening them and closed them again. The governor's latest rules for reopening bars come with stipulations. In order to opt in at all, counties must be in a state hospital trauma service area where 15% or fewer of the hospitalizations over the past week had been for COVID-19. In Trauma Service Area J, which is home to a wide swath of counties, including the Tri-County and the Midland-Odessa area, hospitals hit 6.72% of hospitalizations for COVID-19, still below the threshold. In Jeff Davis County, the issue around bars is a moot point. The county has no bars that were affected by the closures, temporary county judge Larry Francell said in an interview Monday. The closest thing the county has to a bar is a bar restaurant at the Hotel Olympia, but as a dining establishment, it was never shuttered by Governor Abbott's orders closing bars. And besides, Francell said he already had confidence that Olympia had adequate precautions in place and was handling the coronavirus well. I think he's doing this right, Francell said of owner Charles Mallory and the precautions at the Olympia. Why should we get involved? The story is similar in Marfa. At the start of the coronavirus crisis, the town had two establishments that technically qualified as bars: House Bar on the west side of town and Lost Horse on the east. House Bar has been closed more or less continuously throughout the coronavirus crisis. As for Lost Horse, it was closed by state orders earlier this year, but then a new owner bought it and revamped the bar's food menu. That allowed Lost Horse to reopen earlier this summer, technically as a food establishment. The situation isn't much different in Presidio either. Presidio residents have been working to rehab the local VFW with the goal of eventually offering bar service, but that hasn't happened yet, Presidio Mayor John Ferguson said in an interview on Tuesday. The closest thing Presidio has to a bar is the Trading Post, where before the crisis, residents often gathered in the evening for beers and billiards. But the Trading Post, which serves chicken wings and other fare, also technically qualifies as a food establishment, according to Ferguson. And while the bar's patio has reopened, these days it's also offering takeout orders. In an interview on Friday, Judge Guevara said she hadn't yet read the full order and didn't want to make any final decisions before speaking to county commissioners and to Dr. John Paul J.P. Schwartz, the Presidio County Health Authority. But as she saw it, reopening bars was a bad idea. Right off the bat, for myself, I think no, Guevara said of the prospect of adapting these laxer rules in Presidio County. When people drink alcohol, they relax. They forget precautions. This is a pandemic. Despite the recent rise in case numbers across Tri-County, Brewster County does technically meet the requirements to opt in to the expanded reopening rules. And at the commissioner's court meeting, County Judge Eleazar Cano described opting in as a formality rather than a choice for county officials. "I'm going to be signing off on this," Cano said of the new rules. He told commissioners there was no need to hold a vote.
Good day. I am Tamanoy Amy Speedy Borte, reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 8, 2020. No one injured in KFC Taco Bell fire, by Nathan Ewer, Pioneer editor. No one was injured in the fire that engulfed the KFC Taco Bell in Fort Stockton early Sunday morning, according to Fort Stockton Fire Department Chief Jesse Domingos. Fire crews responded to a call that the business located at 1304 North US Highway 285 was on fire at 3:24 a.m. on Sunday. The fire department had the fire put about approximately 6 a.m. There was heavy smoke upon arrival. Shortly later is when flames started getting to the roof, Domingos said. Domingos added that the cause of the fire is still under investigation. The business, which is a complete loss, closed at midnight. No surrounding properties were damaged. The Fort Stockton Police Department, Pecos County Sheriff's Office, and Pecos County Emergency Management Services were all on the scene in effort to help the Fort Stockton Fire Department with the fire. Two injured in car accident. On Monday, October 5, around 4:25 p.m., there was a two-vehicle crash at the intersection of Highway 285 and Fifth Street in Fort Stockton. A male driver, 26-year-old Michael A. James, was heading east of Fifth Street in a Honda Accord when he failed to yield when merging onto Highway 285. The vehicle was struck on its driver's side by a Ford pickup, which was drove by 15-year-old Adrian Ramirez, according to Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lucian. The vehicle came to rest in Rooney Park, where the jaws of life were used to remove the driver door. The driver was taken to Memorial Hospital in an ambulance, and the passenger of the car, Jacqui Wang, 26, was life-flighted. COVID-19 cases continue to spike. Over the past 2 weeks, the number of active COVID-19 cases has risen in Pecos County, growing from 6 people on September 22nd to 46 people as of Tuesday, October 6th. The number of active cases has more than doubled from the previous week, as there were 22 on Tuesday, September 29. At the regular weekly COVID-19 update on October 1st, which is broadcasted every week via Facebook Live by the Fort Stockton Pioneer, Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander and Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster said the rise in numbers is partly due to the traveling to Mexico by Pecos County residents. One of the reasons they're growing right now is we're seeing and hearing of more traveling to Mexico, Schuster said. That really needs to stop until the numbers in Mexico come down, and I will urge everyone at this point in time to use a telephone and call your relatives in Mexico. Let's do it that way for a while. The county judge added, Pecos County is in line with the active case number in the state of Texas. For the week of September 19, the average number of daily positive tests in the state were at 3,258 people. For the week of September 26, the average number of daily positive tests jumped to 6,414 people, Schuster stated. Not only are we seeing a climb in the numbers, the whole state of Texas is seeing the climb, Schuster said. Also addressed during the update was trick or treating in the county. Mayor Alexandra, in agreement with Schuster, said that trick or treating is still a goal as of October 1st. Alexandra emphasized that COVID-19 guidelines set by the county and state still need to be followed when doing so. The mayor also left the door open for a change in their decision leading up to Halloween. We're leaving it as is, but we're going to be looking at it on a week-to-week basis as to whether we'll allow trick-or-treating a lot, Alexandra said. We agreed we'll allow trick-or-treating as long as all the rules are followed. Everyone wear your COVID mask and not your Halloween mask. Adults who are handling out candies need to wear masks. Schuster added that there is certainly a possibility of cancelling trick-or-treating in the county in the coming weeks if the numbers continue to rise. I have spoken to some people in Iran, and they are a goal for Halloween also. Now, if the numbers continue to rise in the county the way they did this last week, in a week or so, we may decide to cancel Halloween. Right now, we don't want to say we want to cancel it. We want to get the numbers down. As of October 5th, there has been a total of 2,187 people tested in Pecos County. Of those tests, 1,788 have come back negative. There are 29 tests pending and a total of 295 positive tests since the start of the pandemic. A total of 243 people have recovered from COVID-19. The number of deaths in the county has stayed at 6 since August 15, which was when the last COVID-related death occurred. Food truck fire in Walmart parking lot ruled accidental. GoFundMe page created to help with damage cost. The Z Fusion Twist food truck in Fort Stockton caught on fire on Friday, October 2nd, in the Walmart parking lot around 8:30 p.m. Owner Paul Manoshin said that him and his wife stopped by Walmart on their way home with their food truck trailer after serving food that day at Ace Hardware, the truck's regular location of service. We were coming home and decided to get food at Walmart so we could cook at home, Manoshin said. We don't know what happened. She just gave me a call while I was inside Walmart and said the trailer is burning. Manoshin added that he immediately removed everything flammable from the trailer that he could, which included the propane and generator. No one was hurt and no other vehicles were damaged in the parking lot. Fort Stockton Fire Department Chief J.C. Domingos noted that the incident was accidental and was caused by grease in the vent hood system of the trailer. The fire did not completely destroy the food truck, although costs of repairs could be over $10,000, according to Manoshin. The owner has yet to decide whether him and his wife would need to get a new trailer or salvage their damaged truck as of Sunday, October 4th. Items that were destroyed included the ventilation system, the grill, both fryers, wiring and lighting, among other items. The food truck, which first opened on June 6, 2019 in Fort Stockton, has a GoFundMe page link on their Facebook. You can find the food truck Facebook page by searching for Z Fusion Twist. Midland College grad enjoys career with City by Rebecca Bell. Most 33-year-olds can't say they have had the same employer for 15 years. However, Crystal Lopez certainly can. She has worked for the City of Fort Stockton since she was 17 and a senior at Fort Stockton High School. Since 2005, Lopez has maintained full-time employment with the City and received various promotions while also raising a family and obtaining an associate degree from Midland College. I was fortunate to start my career early in life, Lopez said. My first job at the City of Fort Stockton was as an utilities clerk. For the past 13 years, I have been working in the CVB, Convention and Visitors Bureau, and have been director of CVB for 7 years. As director of the Fort Stockton CVB, Lopez oversees public relations and marketing for tourism in Fort Stockton. She supervises 4 employees, including an assistant and a 3-person maintenance team that is responsible for maintaining the visitor center and historic downtown area. She would also be involved in the planning of the Fort Stockton's Convention Event Center. In 2011, Lopez graduated from Midland College with an Associate of Applied Science degree in Business Administration. Fortunately, she was able to take all her classes at the Williams Regional Technical Training Center, WRTTC, Midland College Branch Campus in Fort Stockton. I'm not sure if obtaining a degree would have been possible had it not been for the WRTTC, Lopez explained. It was convenient and accommodating, which was especially important for me as a working mother. Crystal and Isaiah Granado have three children, a 16-year-old daughter and two sons, ages 11 and 4. Granado owns the Auto Bain Auto Detailing and Service Shop in Fort Stockton. Even though the family lead active lives, Lopez is still finding time to continue her education. I've been visiting with Andres Madrid, WRTTC advisor, and discussing options for pursuing a bachelor's degree, Lopez said. Soon, I'll begin taking classes towards a bachelor's degree in organizational management from Midland College. Most of the classes for the organization management program are online, so Lopez said that she will be able to take classes in the evenings and on weekends. There's no reason why I shouldn't keep striving to better myself, Lopez explained. Also, I want to set an example for my children. I want them to know that education is important and the key to having a good life. We are so lucky that we have a Midland College campus in Pecos County. Scholarships are available through Scholars Dollar Program, and the classes are small, so the instructors are able to answer questions and give help when needed. If you live in Fort Stockton, there are no excuses not to pursue higher education. Do something, your guide to local places to go and things to do. If you have an event for our Do Something listing, please email Nathan Ewer at NathanEwer@FortStocktonPioneer.com. Tuesday, October 20, Jesse Calloway Worshipful Master Meeting, Fort Stockton Masonic Lodge, 10:22 a.m. and a.m. The meeting will take place at 7:30 p.m. at 600 North Water Street. Friday, Wednesday, October 16 to 21st, Fort Stockton Community Theatre will hold its next play, a reprise of The Odd Couple, the female version written by Neil Simon and directed by Alice Dukeson, performed by special arrangement with Samuel French Inc. Neil Simon's The Odd Couple entertained Broadway audiences as well as movie and television audiences. FSCT has delighted audiences with both the female and the male versions of the play and is planning to again. Sitting will be limited. Reservations will be required. Friday to Saturday, October 30 to 31st, Earth's Ed Crossing Celebration. The Pecos County Historical Commission, PCHC, will commemorate the various historical figures who passed over these well-known crossings throughout the 16th to 19th centuries, including the Comanche War Trail, the Immigrants Trail, the Butterfield Overland Stage, and the Goodnight Loving Trail, made famous by Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. Friday, December 4th. The Season of Hope 2020 Christmas Parade will be aired on Friday, December 4th, 2020. December 4th, 2020 at 6:30 p.m. Parade lineup begins at 5:30 p.m. on Rio Street. Contact the chamber after 10 a.m. Friday, December 4th to get your assigned lineup spot. Assignment are subject to change. Check in at lineup to confirm. please visit www.fortstockton.org/events to see COVID-19 guidelines and restrictions for the event. Do Something, your guide to local places to go and things to do. If you have an event for our Do Something listing, please email Nathan Ewer at nathan.hewer@fortstocktonpioneer.com. Tuesday, October 20, Jesse Calloway Worshipful Master Meeting, Fort Stockton Masonic Lodge number 1022 AF and AM. The meeting will take place at 7:30 p.m. at 600 North Water Street. Friday, Wednesday, October 16 to 21st, Fort Stockton Community Theatre will hold its next play, a reprise of The Old Couple. The female version, written by Neil Simon and directed by Alice Dukerson, performed by special arrangement with Samuel French, INC. Neil Simon's The Odd Couple entertained the Broadway audiences as well as movie and television audiences. FSCT has delighted audiences with both the male and female versions of the play and is planning to again. Seating will be limited. Reservations will be required. Friday, Saturday, October 30 to 31st. Us Edge Crossing Celebration, the Pecos County Historical Commission, PCHC, will commemorate the various historical figures who passed over this well-known crossing throughout the 16th to the 19th centuries, including the Comanche War Trail, the Emigrant Trail, the Butterfield Overland Stage, and the Goodnight Loving Trail, made famous by Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. Friday, December 4, 2020. The Season of Hope 2020 Christmas Parade will be held on Friday, December 4th, 2020 at 6:30 p.m. Parade lineup begins at 5:30 p.m. on Rio Street. Contact the chamber after 10 a.m. Friday, December 4th, to get your assigned lineup spot. Assignments are subject to change. Check in at lineup to confirm. Please visit www.fortstockton.org/events to see COVID-19 guidelines and restrictions for the event.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 8th. School continues to demand first grader gets haircut. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The grooming and dress code policy at Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD has been at the center of controversy over the last month after a Tatum Elementary first grader was to be suspended from in-person instruction since his mother, Rebecca Kynes, refused to get his shoulder-length haircut. Even after Kynes provided proof of his Native American lineage to the district, the superintendent of schools, Chad Smith, still denied his hair length to be acceptable, Kynes said. In early September, the Texas arm of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, sent a letter to MWPISD, as well as over 400 other school districts across the state, asking them to revise dress code policies that it says are unconstitutional and discriminatory. The ACLU also said that, in August, the Texas Association of School Boards updated its guidance to encourage schools not to enforce gender-specific grooming codes. Kynes originally only asked the district about the process of getting on the school board agenda to address the policy, but was told, a day after ACLU's letter was mailed out, she must go through a grievance process. Smith has allowed Kynes' child to remain in school while going through this process. Kynes began the grievance process with MWP ISD and had her Level 1 meeting with Tatum Elementary Principal Jill Steen on September 21st, including in her complaint recent court rulings stating dress codes that are gender-specific are a violation of an individual's civil liberties, and the decision to suspend her son unless he gets his hair cut violates his civil rights and is discriminatory toward his gender. Kynes received a written response from Steen on September 30th. The response letter from Steen concluded with, quote, "As administrators of MWP ISD, we must adhere to and comply with adopting school board dress code policy regarding males' hair length, and therefore, at this Level 1 hearing, the remedy being sought by Mrs. Kynes cannot be met," end quote. Quote, "The response was pretty much as I suspected. Mrs. Steen cannot do anything about the policy, and there was nothing that came of the meeting other than wasting her time and mine. I do not understand why it took 15 days from the day I requested the meeting to get this response," Kynes said. Kynes said she requested and was denied an opportunity to begin the grievance process at Level 2, since, according to FNG Local, page 4, paragraph 3, section 2, under Level 1 policy, quote, "If the only administrator who has the authority to remedy the alleged problem is the superintendent or designee, the complaint may begin at Level 2 following the procedures, including deadlines for filing the complaint from at Level 1, end quote. Quote, "To me, this means Mrs. Steen cannot make this decision, and Mr. Smith had previously told the newspaper he cannot make the decision either. So, at a minimum, I should have been able to skip Level 1 and save everyone some time," she added. When the news asked Smith why Kynes was not able to skip Level 1, Smith said he was, quote, "not going to discuss that with us because he did not feel like that is something that belonged in the newspaper and he believed we were misunderstanding the policy," end quote. Smith went on to say the first meeting he had with Kynes was not a part of the grievance process and she was still required to follow the grievance process since she was not satisfied with the decision at Level 1. Kynes was required to file an appeal at Level 2, which is a conference with the superintendent. The appeal has to be filed in writing within 10 days of the date of the written Level 1 response. Kynes filed the response on October 6th, which gives Smith until October 20th to set a meeting. In her appeal, Kynes explained she disagreed with the outcome of the Level 1 grievance because, quote, "the administrator at Level 1 does not possess the ability to rectify the discriminatory policy, therefore the meeting was a waste of our time, and Level 1 should have been skipped per district policy," end quote. She went on to reference the FNG local policy on page 4, paragraph 3, section 2, under Level 1 in her appeal. Quote, "I feel like the district will stand by the policy because they do not want to admit they were wrong, but that's okay. We will continue to go through the process little by little until we get there, but I will not cut my son's hair," she added. A petition started on Facebook calling for the district to make changes to the hair and dress codes has received 833 signatures since its conception. The Monahans News will follow this story and present new updates as they become available. No derailment and train truck collision on Sunday. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. An eastbound freight train collided with a tractor trailer shortly before sunrise on Sunday morning, resulting in serious damage to the truck, but less serious damage to the locomotive. There were no injuries or train derailment in the incident. According to Department of Public Safety Information Officer Sergeant Oscar Villarreal, the truck, which was on the I-20 frontage road near mile marker 57, blew a tire and veered off the road and came to rest on the railroad tracks around 6 a.m. Before the truck could be towed off of the tracks, the oncoming Union Pacific train collided with the truck a short time later. The locomotive sustained damage to the front of the engine, but could be moved and was routed to a sidetrack, and the train then continued on its route. The truck was unoccupied at the time of the incident. The incident is being investigated by DPS Trooper Cody Gale. Sullivan accused of sexually assaulting a child under age 14. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A Monahans man was arrested on a charge of aggravated sexual assault of a child after being named as a suspect in a sexual assault case involving a victim under the age of 14. Calvin L. Sullivan, age 50, of 1514 South Betty Street, was arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail on Thursday, October 1st, on a Ward County warrant for aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony. According to Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle, quote, on July 7th, deputies were notified by the Texas Department of Family and Protection Services, DFPS, of a possible sexual assault of a child under the age of 14, end quote. Through the course of the investigation by the Ward County Sheriff's Office, in collaboration with DFPS, Sullivan was named as a suspect. Quote, an arrest warrant for Sullivan was issued on September 30th, and he was subsequently arrested and charged him with aggravated sexual assault of a child, he said. Valle added, quote, there are two elements that make a sexual assault case aggravated, the victim being under the age of 14, and the use of threats, force, weapons, or drugs, end quote. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of 5 to 99 years or life, and or a fine not to exceed $10,000. Bond was set at $50,000, and Sullivan remains in custody at the Ward County Jail in lieu of posting the bond. Swanson sends three to prison on drug charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Jimmy Dan Rollins, age 56, of 2101 West 2nd Street, Ashley Martinez, age 33, of 1505 West 2nd Street, and Alex Ramirez Marquez, age 34, of 3600 South Helen Street, were sentenced on September 29th in the 143rd Judicial District Court by Judge Mike Swanson to 8, 6, and 4 years, respectively, in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. All three defendants waived their rights to a jury trial and accepted plea deals. Rollins pled guilty to possession of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, greater than 4 grams, less than 200 grams. Martinez pled guilty to prohibited substance in a correctional facility, and Marquez pled to possession of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, greater than 1 gram, less than 4 grams. Rollins was indicted on February 27th by the grand jury for the 143rd Judicial Court for the offense. The indictment stated that on or about December 12, 2019, Rollins did and knowingly possessed a controlled substance, namely methamphetamine, in an amount of 4 grams or more, but less than 200 grams. The indictment goes on to read, Rollins was convicted of two other felony offenses, possession of cocaine on September 8, 1988, and possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine on December 8, 2014. Rollins was also one of the seven individuals arrested on methamphetamine charges in December 2019 after Monahans police officers located murder suspects Joseph Delane Locke and Tanner Joseph Weeks' vehicle at their residence in the 2100 block of West 2nd Street where Rollins resided. A search of the residence netted a large amount of methamphetamine. Locke and Weeks were later booked on capital murder charges related to the killing of Detrevion Tremel Fields. Martinez was indicted by the grand jury for the 143rd Judicial Court on May 2, 2019, for the charge. The indictment stated that on or about March 13, 2019, Martinez did and knowingly possessed a controlled substance, namely methamphetamine, while in the Ward County Jail. Martinez was originally sentenced to probation for the offense in October 2019, but failed to meet the requirements of the deferred adjudication. Marquez was indicted by the grand jury for the 143rd Judicial Court on December 30, 2019. The indictment stated that on or about September 3, 2019, Marquez did and knowingly possessed a controlled substance, namely methamphetamine, in an amount of 1 gram or more, but less than 4 grams. Both Rollins and Marquez were further ordered to pay $393 in court costs and $180 in restitution to the DPS Restitution Accounting Office in Austin. Martinez was ordered to pay $314 in court costs and $180 in restitution. Rollins was also given credit for 293 days toward his sentence. Martinez was credited for 207 days, and Marquez was credited for 241 days. Trent Graham represented Martinez and Rollins, and Marquez was represented by David Savoda. Randall W. Reynolds served as attorney for the state on all three cases.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.